superior news and issues from a superior point of
view. Hurry, hurry, call the police.
By all means, call the police in an emergency, but after January, Superior's top cop will be retired.
I sit here, you know, humbled being able to have been the chief of this department for the last 9 years.
Chief Nick Alexander looks back. Plus, if it sounds like thousands of voices, it's close. The University of Wisconsin Superior Music Department presents A Season of Song. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We'll hear more of that fabulous holiday concert in a bit, but first, a public servant hangs up his hat and badge. Nick Alexander first joined the Superior Police Department in 1998. He's worked as a patrol officer and in a variety of administrative roles, culminating with his appointment as chief 9 years ago. Not long after, the department instituted body cameras, and he's introduced other reforms and initiatives, most recently the Pathways to Hope program, which offers criminal diversion and treatment for those with substance addictions. But all that comes to a close for Nick next month when he retires from the force. He's not leaving without saying goodbye, and he joins me now. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Chief Alexander.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
So before we walk down memory lane, what's in the future? Are you retiring to warmer climates or staying in the area because you love 20 below or what else is out there?
Sure. Well, I am definitely staying in the area. You know, I still have one child in school, but I do have a couple plans. One is going to be at UWS. I joined the faculty there on January 24th, and I'll be starting with that semester teaching three classes in the Criminal Justice and Legal Studies program. And then some people know, some people don't, that I own a restaurant and lodge about 30 miles north of Duluth, so I plan to focus some more efforts with that endeavor as well.
Well, if they don't know, let's tell them. What's the name of the restaurant? Where is it?
So the restaurant's called the Pequon Inn. It's up Highway 44, about 35 minutes north of Duluth. You know, it's a full-service restaurant, and then it sits on the trailhead for the snowmobile trails, you know, in northern Minnesota. And you mentioned, you know, trying to escape the cold weather. I actually look forward to it because I am an avid snowmobiler, so... at some point, I hope that we really get some snow soon.
Yeah, that would be nice. Well, let's take a look back. You took over as chief right on the heels of the Natasha Lacour incident, in which police were accused of using excessive force against a prominent Superior activist. That was eventually settled with a judgment for her, and she remains a very active and involved community member. Without getting into the specifics, what was the mood when you took over?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that that incident did kind of set the tone for the beginning of my term as chief. I wanted to improve community engagement and trust and legitimacy out in the public. And when you have an incident like that, that brings, you know, public criticism to the department, it certainly is a challenge to, you know, maintain the trust and confidence in the community. So that was a big part of what I wanted to do. I wanted to, you know, improve the department and our standing in the public from that incident. So you kind of mentioned one of the first strategies for that was the implementation of the body-worn cameras, that helping our community members, especially those that, you know, have concerns with the police, giving them the confidence that their interactions are being recorded. So if there is some question as to the professionalism or conduct of officers on a call, that, you know, we have a reliable way to go back and investigate those.
You know, at the time, it's much different than the perception today. I mean, because today they're everywhere and people are so used to seeing videos of everything. And I think at this point, people know that what you see in video may not be the entire story one way or the other. What happened before the camera was turned on, what happened after it was turned off or it went off or whatever. But the reception by rank and file officers across the country wasn't exactly... you know, the most, yeah, we want to do this. So what did it take to convince your force?
yeah, you're right. Some in law enforcement, you know, change is difficult. And I think there's always fears that systems like that, whether you're a police officer or the public, you know, when you talk about cameras, they think, you know, kind of like Big Brother, that everything is going to be watched. But we tried to share with the department, you know, what our goals of the system was. And it was to, you know, gain greater trust and legitimacy with the public, be able to demonstrate many times the good work that we do. And we involved our police union into the policy development for it. So they understood exactly, you know, how we were going to utilize them. And part of that was, you know, some assurance that, you know, we're not going to use the cameras to look for a uniform violation or, you know, something petty like that. You know, we're going to use them, one, to record our interactions with the public. Oftentimes they help us preserve or collect evidence, you know, by memorializing it on video. And when we do have complaints, it gives us an opportunity to really fairly and equitably investigate them. And kind of to piggyback off of what you already said, how things have changed, my officers now would be upset if we took those away. I mean, they view them as a very valuable tool and resource.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Superior Police Chief Nicholas Alexander. He's retiring next month after 25 years with the department, the last 9 as chief. Duluth, what's it been like working with a city right next door on the other side of the bridge? And criminal activity and incidents don't necessarily stop at the bridge, right? So how do you deal with your neighbors and fellow departments?
You bet. No, we have a great relationship with Duluth PD. A little history there is my father's a retired Duluth police officer, so I've always had a tremendous amount of respect for the Duluth Police Department. And as chief, I think I've been able to work with 3 Duluth chiefs. I guess that kind of shows how long I've stayed in my position. But we've definitely built some good relationships there. We share equipment across the borders. We staff officers in different special investigations units in Duluth PD, and they do here as well. You know, we try to look for efficiencies, you know, with equipment in these task forces to be able to do things as productively as we can, you know, especially when you look at specialized investigations like computer crimes or drug cases. And those relationships have proven to be very good. You know, Duluth and Superior is a very unique area. The Twin Ports Metropolitan Statistical Area, you know, a lot of people, you know, they just look at the cities of Duluth or Superior and they're not big cities, but as a metropolitan area, we are a pretty large population base. You know, I think within 60 miles of the port, you know, roughly 250,000 people live. So that's a pretty good population base, and our society is very mobile. So kind of as you mentioned, you know, the criminal element doesn't really care if they're in Wisconsin or Minnesota. So there is a lot of cross-border activity. So having those relationships with our partners on both sides of the state line has been very valuable.
Mm-hmm. Are there any cases where somebody thought there was like, I don't know, maybe they headed across the bridge and said, hi, you can't catch me now, I'm in Duluth. I mean, I know you have hot pursuit rules, but tell me about
right.
that.
Right. Well, I do think certainly, you know, it reminds me of the Dukes of Hazzard. You know, once they always hit Hazzard County line, the law enforcement stopped and the other person got away. But that's generally not how it works in real life. And with us, although we are 2 states, we have mutual aid agreements in place that, you know, allow Duluth officers to enter into Superior under the right set of circumstances and vice versa for us over there.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the Pathways to Hope program.
Yes, so I appreciate you mentioning that in the opening comments. It's certainly, when I look back at my career here, that's going to be one of the highlights. One, because it really reflects a significant change in policing and a culture change within, you know, law enforcement, at least in our department, where historically our response to calls for service that involved, you know, some sort of crime and then a person who was using drugs almost always resulted in incarceration. You know, whether the crime was a fraud or a theft or a burglary, you know, probably being done to help fund their drug addiction, our response was always to put the person in jail. And they would get out and the cycle would continue. And, you know, we look at it and it's like, well, we shouldn't expect it to be any different. We're not addressing the root cause. And that's what the Pathways to Hope program is supposed to do, is identify those people whose criminal activity is really the result of their addiction. And in those right sets of circumstances, be able to give them almost immediate access to treatment and rehabilitation services in lieu of being arrested. And it's a pretty powerful program. I think we've had over 200 people into it now. Total sobriety or completion of the program is probably in the 20% range, which might seem low to some of your audience, but sure, in the world of recovery, that's pretty good. And to put things into perspective, you know, a person who's addicted to, say, heroin or methamphetamine, and they're committing crimes to fund that addiction, they're committing a lot of crimes to do it. Addiction's an expensive habit. So every person that we can get into recovery, is we're really having a significant impact in crime in our community and quality of life for our citizens. And in many cases, we're also potentially saving a life, you know, by getting that person into treatment. We have far too many overdose deaths, you know, with the powerful opiates based drugs that are out there, you know, people die. So this is really truly a program that can help save a life. And, you know, I do occasionally hear from people who are skeptical of a program like that. And my response to them is pretty simple. I ask them, what wouldn't they do if they had a loved one who was addicted to a drug that could kill them? And their response is, there isn't anything they wouldn't do. And I said, then that's exactly what this program does. It helps give everybody, you know, that one more chance.
We'll be looking into this more. Actually, we're going to dedicate an entire segment to the Pathways for Hope program in the coming months. We've had you on before talking about racial profiling along with a Twin Ports NAACP representative. And I remember by the end of that conversation, you and he were practically two peas in a pod. So have you managed to solve those racial inequities of like traffic stops and such that continue to plague other departments?
You know, I think it's a rolling metric. I do believe that, you know, we are a fair and equitable police department. One of the trainings that we brought in early on was fair and impartial policing. The core focus of that curriculum, which was mandatory for all of our officers, was the concept of bias, you know, particularly unconscious bias that we all have them. It doesn't have to be a bad word, but what's important is that we recognize that to some degree we're a product of our environment, our upbringing, and so on, and that sometimes that plays into our decision-making processes. So having some greater self-awareness that we have those types of biases, I think, gives officers a better chance at being able to recognize it and not allow them to influence the decisions that they make. Mm-hmm. I have, you know, for 9 years, my theme to the department has really been seeking the best outcome. You know, and I think to our department's mission statement, the Superior Police Department sworn to protect, committed to justice, and dedicated to professional service, that middle section, committed to justice, the root word of justice is just, which means to do what's right. And sometimes that does mean that we have to arrest people and bring them to jail. But other times it's looking at other alternatives and resources that we have. Pathways to Hope, as an example, to, you know, help people get on to a better path of life and seek that better outcome.
We're speaking with Superior Police Chief Nicholas Alexander. He's retiring next month after 25 years with the department, the last 9 as chief. Are there any initiatives you hoped for 9 years ago that you weren't able to achieve, or, you know, maybe just became irrelevant or changed?
There is one that I didn't achieve. That was a, you know, some form of a public-facing camera system. You know, I was hoping to be able to accomplish, you know, some cameras on our major roadways, the bridges, some of the higher traffic, you know, streets and roads in Superior, into our business district, around some of our parks. Those are areas that we tend to see our higher calls for service. And, you know, I truly believe, and I still do today, that those systems would can be used in a way that doesn't violate people's privacy, but also at the same time allow us to do a better job at solving some chronic crime problems like vandalism in parks and so on. So that is one that I hope, you know, the future chief will be able to gain some traction and support in the city for. One that I did hope for when I started off as chief that more recently we did accomplish was our coordinated response specialist program. It's kind of aligns with like having a social worker within the department to help our officers deal with populations that are having issues with mental health, drug addiction, homelessness, and poverty. And in many cases allows the uniformed officer to leave and to have a civilian take over and handle that call and get people connected to resources. And we have that currently with Jen Stank. She's our coordinated response specialist. And the program's been very effective to the point where the city council and the 2024 budget allotted funds to add a second response specialist to that program.
Mm-hmm. What's been your proudest or maybe most memorable moment? Maybe two different things there.
Sure. Probably my proudest are the programs like Pathways to Hope and the Coordinated Response Specialist, and largely because I do think that they've recognized a change in the expectations of our community and that some of our traditional methods that police have historically dealt with problems may not be the best. You know, they're kind of progressive programs that I think are, you know, more reflective of modern policing versus the kind of historical philosophies of policing. So those two programs make me proud. Ultimately, I sit here, you know, humbled being able to have been the chief of this department for the last 9 years. I have utmost respect for the men and women who serve on this department. They go out every day, perform a difficult job. Certainly, we're all human. We make mistakes along the way, but they overall deliver an exceptional level of service and professionalism to this community. And being a chief and having such a great staff has certainly helped make my job easier and paved the way for some of the successes that we've talked about. So I really do owe a debt of gratitude to the men and women of this department.
How about most memorable?
There was, I don't want to, you know, give names of victims, but there have been a couple homicides in Superior that I was significantly involved in the investigation and the response to, and although they are tragic situations, they've always been a couple incidents where I felt really a high level of satisfaction knowing that I've at least been able to help those families find some closure and see justice in the outcomes. And it's also a couple of them have also helped me to have a more positive perspective on society. I've seen, you know, survivors where a loved one has been murdered offer forgiveness and not let that, you know, sour in them and, you know, be resentment or so on. And I think that that's just a strong testament to the power of forgiveness and, you know, the ability of us to have empathy and compassion.
We certainly need more than a little of that right now. So what's your advice for your successor?
Yeah, so, you know, I hope that the best chiefs are still to come, you know, starting with Captain Paul Winterscheidt, who will be my successor. I never came into this wanting to be the best chief that, you know, Superior has. I want each one that comes after me to be the best, because that means that our department is continually improving. I was kind of thinking about how's a way to kind of explain that or give an analogy. And I really kind of came up with the relay race, like in track and field, where you carry the baton. So I carried it for 9 years and I did the best that I could during that time. And then you pass it on to some fresh legs that can take it forward. And I believe that, you know, future Chief Winterscheidt will probably continue and strongly support some of these programs like Pathways to Hope and the Coordinated Response Specialist Program. He's actually been the staff member that I've put in charge of those programs for the past couple of years. So mm-hmm. I certainly encourage him to do that. Anytime that we can see opportunities to divert or deflect people from the criminal justice system and maybe put them on a path that, you know, changes their life in a positive and meaningful way, is really powerful.
All right. Well, congratulations on your retirement.
Well, thank you again. You know, it's just been a great career, Robin. It's hard to believe it's gone by so fast. I still remember the first call I went on as a brand new officer on the department. And
well, what was that? You got to share that.
So back when I started 25 years ago, the day shift oftentimes started their shift by going to breakfast at Perkins. So that's where I found myself with my field training officer at 7 a.m. And by about 7:15, a disturbance was called out in the Aspen Linden Court area, and ultimately made an underage drinking and fighting arrest.
So did you ever finish your sausage and eggs?
I think we went back and got it. The funny thing is I still know the person that I arrested that day, and we've joked over the years when he's seen me as chief, and I tell him that he was the first person I ever arrested as a police officer, and he's gone on to, you know, change his path in life from my first contact with him. So
there we go. Pathways to hope right there.
Yep.
All right. We've been speaking with Superior Police Chief Nicholas Alexander. He's retiring next month after 25 years with the department, the last 9 as chief. Thank you for joining us, Nick Alexander.
Well, thank you again, Robin.
Coming up, a holiday concert tradition. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. It's the season, and in Superior, that means it's the Season of Song Holiday Concert by the University of Wisconsin-Superior Music Department at the Cathedral of Christ the King in Superior. The program was held December 3rd and 5th, and it's the 26th annual event that features students and faculty presenting an eclectic mix of holiday music. Some of those are tunes that are very familiar, others may be new to you in the spirit of music education. One of those educators and performers is Rachel Cresha, who teaches at UWS and is also the organist at Christ the King, and occasionally plays secular and liturgical music at other venues in the Twin Ports, including on occasion Temple Israel in Duluth. She joins me along with Riley Hennenkamp, a senior voice major. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Rachel and Riley.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, Rachel, I mentioned this is the 26th annual concert. How long have you been involved, and had you attended before joining it?
Well, I have been involved on and off over the years. As a faculty member, this is my second year doing it. As a postgraduate of my master's program, I did it for 3 years, around 2009 to 2012, I guess. And then as a student of the University of Wisconsin-Superior, I did it for 3 years. It's been a long journey.
Well, I didn't mean to sound like it was a trick question to ask if you're a dinosaur like me. So, but that does actually elicit the question. Is there anybody, do you know, who's actually performed in all 26?
I don't think we've had the same person in all 26.
Who's the veteran?
Maybe Dr. Erin Aldrich. I don't know if she's done all of them, but I know she's so generous and she's just so wonderful that she's always willing to play at these concerts. So I would imagine she probably has done the most.
Right. Well, nowhere near 26. Erin is not, again, the dinosaur that I am. How about Riley? You're a senior, so I would presume 3 years of this?
Yeah, so this is technically my fourth season of song year. So I started school during fall of 2020. So I've had 3 different iterations of season of song. One was during COVID time where we pre-recorded every single piece of music and then had it as a video concert. Recording a choral part over Zoom is pretty tricky. And then we did it the next year during my sophomore year, 2021. We were not at the cathedral. We were actually at Concordia Church, still in Superior. Mm-hmm. And then the past 2 years, we were the kind of, I would call it the normal version of the Season of Song concert at the Cathedral. So I've had three different kind of versions, but I've done it for 4 years now.
We did have Erin Aldridge on. Well, she's been on many times. And during COVID, she was talking about the challenges of, teaching in general, but music education in particular. And actually, she said it kind of worked out into really innovative and effective, how about that, approaches where students like you, Riley, were at home or in a studio somewhere, but isolated from everybody else doing their part. I think she was saying that you could, really concentrate on that one student when you're getting their isolated recording.
Yeah.
But I imagine with a choir, it's a little bit hard to be just by yourself.
So it's a little tricky. We used to record just our voice alone. We'd have the entire track playing, but just our voice would be through the camera. So you just hear, the tenor two part for an entire song. Which song is it? You really don't know. It's just a random tenor part. But
all right. Enough with that. We're back to, in-person concerts. How big was this? How many pieces and voices in the ensemble? And I know at a certain point the audience joined in.
Well, we had two pieces that involved organ, orchestra, choir, and the audience, which just filled the room. I mean, it seemed like there was 1,000 people singing. Mm-hmm. It just seemed bigger than life, and that's what happens when everybody works together on a big familiar tune. Then there were also just some beautiful instrumental sets that Erin Aldrich's group did with strings, these just really wonderful arrangements, and they were playful and light. And then Riley can probably speak more about this, but then there was some beautiful chamber choir music with a smaller group, and then the larger choir ensemble, sometimes with orchestral accompaniment, and then sometimes just a cappella.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear
and then it. Two organ solos. Sorry.
Oh, no. How could you forget that? Yes. Well, let's hear some of it. Let's hear, something extremely familiar. O Come All Ye Faithful. Any setup to this at all? This is the choir sort of leading it, Riley?
Yeah. So this was the first kind of piece where everything was put together. Rachel played this really wonderful intro right after the opening to the concert. This was the first time any of the audience members heard the orchestra, the organ, and the choir full volume singing.
All right, let's hear O Come All Ye Faithful as part of the Season of Song concert by the University of Wisconsin-Superior Music Department.
Thank you.
was O Come All Ye Faithful as part of the Season of Song Concert by the University of Wisconsin-Superior Music Department at Christ the King Cathedral in Superior on December 3rd and also December 5th. Our local station, KUWS, will be broadcasting the concert in its entirety, or at least most of it, on December 22nd. We're speaking with organist and music teacher Rachel Kreisha and voice student Riley Hennenkamp, both of the University of Wisconsin-Superior. Rachel, tell us a little bit about playing liturgical music in general. I mentioned you've been an accompanist at Temple Israel in Duluth for the Jewish High Holiday services. Who else do you play for, and how do you approach it?
Oh, my goodness. Well, yes, I think I help fill in many churches in the area if the local musician has a family member that's sick and has some unexpected time away. We all fill in for each other. Hmm. And so I've played at Pilgrim Congregational Church, UCC, First Lutheran in Duluth, Concordia in Duluth. Goodness, the list can go on and on.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed both in different synagogues that I personally have attended, and then also as a journalist, I've covered religion quite a bit, and noticed in particular Catholic churches would have different melodies to the same hymn. It almost is like this is our house melody. Do you notice that as you go around, and you know, what does it take to adjust, if I'm correct about that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So if you think of a hymn as a poem that has a certain meter, you can craft many different tunes to fit the text. And some are more robust and triumphant sounding. Some are more meditative. Some are more easy for a wide group of people to sing together. And some are far more nuanced. And so there is a culture in each space where there's a melody or a tune that just brings people together and they sing it with their heart. You have to approach it with great care and great hospitality.
Riley, given those considerations, you still want to do this? Or,
Oh, I'm all for it. It's so much fun.
What are you planning on concentrating on after graduation?
Yeah, kind of a little bit of a mix of different things. I used to be in the choral education world, and classrooms are just not for me, so I kind of switched up to vocal performance. One of my dreams is actually be in music therapy and help out people with dementia, younger kids, a lot more that kind of healing aspect of music. But I also like to be a traveling performer, kind of going wherever the wind takes me, basically kind of get my name out and try different things.
All right. Well, speaking of different things, one of the songs was an African hymn. Riley, can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So this piece is called Noël, which, I mean, if you ever heard Christmas, Noël is a very common word. It's the French way to say Christmas. This piece starts out with this couple different solo and duets singing the words Noël over and over and over again. And in this context, it just means rejoice. And then all of a sudden, it just ramps up. When the basses come in, they keep singing rejoice, rejoice, rejoice in the African dialect. And it really just never slows down. It just, the gas pedal is on the entire time until the very, very end.
All right. Rachel, I don't think you have a gas pedal on your organ, but a few other pedals, right?
It's like more of a combustion engine, I would say.
Okay, well, we'll let the African percussion and our wonderful UWS choir voices take us through Noël.
Thank you.
And that was Noel, an African version, from the Season of Song concert by the University of Wisconsin Music Department at Christ the King Cathedral. Let's go out to the cast of thousands. You mentioned in the beginning, Rachel, that everybody joined in for the finale. So tell us what that was.
It's a piece based on the first Noel. The arrangement that we used is by a contemporary composer, Dan Forrest. And he sets this beloved tune just in a gentle, warm sound of the organ and strings. It starts very gently, and it just keeps growing and growing. And he uses a few edgy harmonies and a few disjunct sounding things so that when the final Noel comes in, it's just glorious, where we're all just playing and singing with everything we have.
All right. And I bet that everybody passing by on Belknap Street was also singing along. We've been singing. No, we haven't been singing. We've been speaking with organist and music teacher Rachel Kreischer. You don't need to hear me sing. And voice student Riley Hennigan of the University of Wisconsin Superior. They're two of a cast of thousands, it feels like, who performed at the Season of Song concert at the University of Wisconsin Superior Music Department at Christ the King Cathedral. Our local station, KUWS, will be broadcasting the concert on December 22nd. Thank you for joining us, Rachel O'Reilly.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, the regional news and review. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and we're joined by Rick Lubbers of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
And Shelley Nelson of the Superior Telegram. Hi, Shelley.
Hello, Robin.
So, Rick, Roger Reinhart is preparing for his inauguration as Duluth's next mayor next month, but he's already shuffling chairs at City Hall.
Yes, he is. Mayor-elect Roger Reinhart announced Wednesday his intentions to replace the city's administrator and lead attorney when he takes office in January. Reinhart proposes to replace city administrator Noah Schuckman with David Montgomery, who formerly held the same position under both Mayor Don Ness and outgoing Mayor Emily Larson. He also proposes to remove city attorney Rebecca St. George and place Jessica Fralick in that role. Fralick currently serves as a referee with the 6th Judicial District Court and formerly worked for the St. Louis County Attorney's Office. She also has experience in private practice, including involvement with domestic violent cases. But Reinhart's proposed staffing decisions also come with a price tag attached to needed severance packages. Reinhart said that Schuckman was in line to receive 6 months' pay upon his departure. That would be worth about $84,000, while 4 months of pay for St. George would be about $47,000, putting the total price tag just over $132,000. In the future, Reinhart said he would like to see the contracts of people in city leadership roles run concurrently with the mayor's term. He acknowledged that there would be a cost to the staffing changes and said he believes the council made a mistake in the past by having contracts that run past an election or past a mayor's term. As for the selection of Montgomery to lead the city workforce, Reiner described him as a time-tested and respected known quantity who has agreed to come out of retirement and serve in a transitional role as the mayor-elect seeks out a longer-term hire within the coming year. Montgomery said he is pleased to serve in a transitional capacity, providing Reiner with the time and space needed to thoughtfully pick his replacement. As for the dismissals of Schuckman and St. George, Reiner said there is no shortcoming or deficiency there, that they're both excellent professionals. It's really more of an issue of those two other people being more closely aligned with where he wants to be headed in the next year. In regards to Freilich's new proposed role, Reiner said that she brings strong relationships with the county, the courts, community agencies, and both Duluth Police and Sheriff's Office, as well as experience meeting people in their difficult moments in toughest chapters of life.
All right. Well, I'm assuming those new employees will get parking spaces. What about the rest of us downtown?
Yes, parking considerations took center stage Monday evening as city councilors voted to lift mandatory minimum parking requirements and approved a plan to sell two downtown parking ramps to a prospective housing developer. More than a year of work went into crafting a policy that will give developers more freedom to judge for themselves what their parking needs will be. Councilors predict that by allowing developers to be more flexible, the city can encourage more affordable housing to be built, since providing off-street parking can be an expensive endeavor that drives rents higher. On another parking-related front, the council unanimously voted in support of a plan to sell the Tech Village and Medical District ramps to a developer who is looking to bring at least 200 units of housing to downtown Duluth. Beautiful City Development LLC may soon be positioned to buy the two parking structures at 14 East 1st Street and 302 East 1st Street for $7 million. The ramps will provide an opportunity to meet tenants' parking needs while still maintaining public parking. The agreement ensures at least a 7-year commitment to honor existing parking contracts and to provide access to 100 public parking stalls in each ramp.
All right. And the state of Minnesota has narrowed down the design ideas for its new flag.
It's getting closer. The panel picking the new Minnesota flag on Tuesday shrunk the field of finalists from 6 to 3, advancing designs with prominent stars but far different concepts. Designers of several flags appeared before the panel earlier in the day, explaining why they chose colors and concepts and what they represent. John Muller, a Texas resident born in Mankato, made the trip north to make the case for his flag. It shows a North Star at the top, as well as a white wave across the flag separating green and blue. Pete Pittman designed the so-called mirror in the sky image with his son, Todd Pittman. He said they were inspired by astronomy and the lure of the loon, which is abstract in the design. The third has three solid horizontal bars intersecting with a Minnesota-shaped area and punctuated by a white star. It was designed by Andrew Precker of Luverne, Minnesota, who said he was inspired by his time growing up in the state. No matter which flag they choose, it will be a departure from the current banner, which was a replicated state seal on a blue background that has been criticized as both muddled and culturally insensitive. Members have already whittled more than 2,000 flag proposals to 6 in the past month, and now they're down to 3. There were fewer seal entries, but still robust debate. Members have a deadline at the end of the year to pick new emblems. That flag will take flight in May, barring the legislative veto.
Well, Shelley, if I want to get rid of my old 8-track player in Superior, I'll soon be able to take it somewhere other than the trash bin.
Well, technically in Wisconsin, you can't take it to the trash bin. You have to recycle it.
Right.
Okay. And the Public Works Committee is working on that. They've made a recommendation for the city to contract with Electrical Manufacturers Recycling Management Company out of Minneapolis. They have a contract with companies like Samsung and HP that make electronics, because state law requires manufacturers of electronics to pay for a certain percentage of their waste. People would be able to drop off their electronics over at the Superior landfill. MRM would transport those to recyclers, and it wouldn't cost anything. Currently, you can still drop off your electronics at the landfill, but it's going to cost you anywhere from $10 to $30, depending on what you're dropping off.
All right. That would be a lot for a totally useless 8-track.
Yeah.
Well, finally, a pair of Superior High School students have come up with ways to make the streets and buildings park safer.
Yeah, Madeline Carey and Jacqueline Samarzia are seniors at Superior High School. Last week, the mayor put an agenda item for Public Works to consider because the girls were taking an academic writing class at the college, and their assignment was to find something in the community they thought needed to be fixed. Well, Jacqueline happens to live close to the intersection of Maryland and North 16th, where there have been 9 accidents in the last 5 or 6 years. So they thought a two-way stop there would be a good idea. Now, these girls really dug in. They talked to the neighbors. They collected traffic data. They learned about the process for changing the traffic ordinance. They consulted the manual on uniform traffic devices. And they even considered the budgetary impact of installing a new two-way sign. The mayor was so impressed that he said, okay, let's put this on agenda. And the Public Works Committee says, yes, we should put this in because there'd been 9 accidents at that intersection. And nearby intersections, which they also researched, had significantly fewer accidents in the same time period.
Great work, Madeline and Jacqueline. We've been speaking with Shelley Nelson, reporter for the Superior Telegram. Thank you, Shelley.
Thank you.
And Rick Lubbers, executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org, SuperiorTelegram.com, and DuluthNewsTribune.com. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. We leave you with more of the music from the Season of Song concert. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.